Coba apa judulnya? Siapa yang buat tahu sih? Yancin ya? Oh, Andrew. Andrew, tolong judulnya tadi. Andrew, sebentar. Dari beginning. Mungkin kecilin lampu juga. Jadi ini Proto History of Buddhist Translation. Ini jadi apa istilahnya, cakal bakal terjemahan-terjemahan Buddhis dari Gandhari. Oh, keliru nih. Nanti beliau akan mengatakan bahwa sebetulnya judul ini keliru. Harusnya From Gandhari and Pali to Han Dynasty Chinese. Jan Natir nanti mengatakan bahwa ini bukannya Gandhari terus ke Pali terus ke Han, tapi Gandhari and Pali to Han Dynasty Chinese. Jadi cakal bakal terjemahan-terjemahan Buddha Dharma dari Gandhari dan Pali ke bahasa Mandarin. Oke. Please, Andrew. Fast forward bisa juga kan? Kalian nggak bisa dengar ya? Suaranya nggak kedengaran, gimana cara?
And I think about those adoption, that audacious bodhisattva really made the Mahayana, doing something that no one else could do. Or the phrase job market crowding. And I'm remembering of the proliferation of Pure Lands, how they were needed for bodhisattva to reverse and complete the path. Professor Nante works in most of the Buddhist source languages, and she knows well the challenges and pitfalls.
Kita mulai aja, Andrew. Lompatin, Andrew.
And I'd also like to thank Marcus Kerman for the invitation to be here, and of course for the Weber Foundation and the other sponsors for this remarkable gathering possible. It's a very heavy experience for me to be in this room in the presence of so many people who are dedicating their efforts to the translation of these texts. And this is especially so since, as I'm sure you're all aware, the artist translation...
Oh, sedikit keterangan, Andrew, coba stop sebentar, Andrew. Jadi di sini ya, di conference ini, kalau kamu baca buku Inggris, bahasa Inggris, Buddha Dharma, mungkin penerjemahnya duduk di conference ini sih. Hampir semua penerjemah-penerjemahan hadir, penerjemah-penerjemah hadir dalam konferensi ini. Jadi ini untuk jadi keynote speaker. Tadi orang tadi mengatakan yang pemuka, dia dulu muridnya sampai begitu apa terkesannya, dan sekarang bisa mengingat. Okay, please, Andrew.
Academy in the past few decades. More than 20 years ago, when I was an associate professor at Indiana University, my colleague David Hamerman and I wrote a short essay entitled "What Ever Became of Translation." In it, we argue that the work of translating classical Asian texts deserves a lot more respect than it's been in the field of studies. As translators ourselves, we work in an awkward position of trying to make sure that our writers use the required skill they need to produce accurate and nuanced translations and interpretations of Hindu-written texts, respectively, David While at the same time, we felt a strong responsibility to make sure that students knew the reality. And that reality was the translation we looked down on and then we
Ini beliau mengatakan apa, betapa sebetulnya menterjemah, karena beliau ini profesor kan, waktu itu di universitas, kalau hanya menterjemahkan sesuatu itu dianggap rendah, karena bukan tesis sesuatu yang baru dianggap. Tapi nanti apa sebetulnya dari beliau, beliau bisa menunjukkan betapa sukarnya sebetulnya menterjemahkan, karena tidak hanya kata per kata, bukannya Google Translate kan, tapi juga bagaimana caranya membuat apa yang ada di situ itu bisa dimengerti oleh yang lain. apa sangat menarik ini. Okay, please Andrew.
He had a translation of the Hindu word in his text that a key part of his portfolio for tenure or promotion could be that. By way of warning, he used to tell me the story of a search committee meeting, not in Indiana, but at another large university state university, where a senior professor in religious studies at the search committee grabbed one of Hannah's books. Pointed it in the air, waved it down, this is in the book. It's a translation. That gives you an idea of the kind of status of translation in our field at that time. Now, having lived and worked outside the United States for most of the past decade, I'm not entirely sure whether things have gotten better or worse. And I would very much appreciate your comments on that if we have time to discuss it in the question period. But in any case, I'm not going to try to use my time today to try to persuade you.
Kalian bisa dengar yang belakang ya? Okay, right.
Yeah. Of translation. That would surely be preaching to the choir, as the expression goes, or to translate English into English, trying to convert the already converted. So I'm not going to spend my time doing that in my comments today. But I do just want to begin simply by noting that in my view, and I'm sure it's a view that is widely shared in this room, the translation of religious texts is one of the most difficult tasks and one of the most important contributions that we as scholars of Buddhism can possibly undertake.
Beliau mengatakan bahwa sebetulnya menerjemahkan religious text, teks keagamaan ini sangat-sangat penting, terutama dalam agama Buddha, untuk kontribusi itu. Sebelumnya beliau itu membuat komentar bahwa beberapa tahun sebelumnya di Indiana University, di Amerika ini untuk jadi PhD ini sulit sekali. Kalau di Australia ini, apalagi mungkin di negara-negara lain, cuman di Amerika ini untuk completing PhD itu sukar sekali, karena harus research dan produce book gini. Dan ini ada seorang yang menerjemahkan salah satu teks begitu sukarnya, tapi sudah selesai pun profesornya cuma mengatakan this is not a book, it's a just translation. Ini bukan karyamu, ini cuma hanya penerjemah. Padahal kalian tahu sendiri betapa sulitnya menerjemahkan. Right? So it's good. And then that dia mulai membicarakan.
So for someone like myself, what I'd like to do in my talk this morning is different from those in at least two respects. First of all, I would like to focus on Chinese rather than Tibetan scriptures. Discussing scriptures that began to be translated only in the middle of the second century of the common era.
Jadi beliau mengatakan, ini konferensinya tentunya membicarakan mengenai Tibetan text, karena yang sponsor Chatra Foundation Tibetan. Cuman beliau akan membicarakan mengenai Chinese text. Lalu beliau mengatakan yang sudah mulai diterjemahkan di abad kedua. Jadi abad kedua Chinese text sudah mulai menerjemahkan Buddhis teks ini di sini, dan nanti beliau akan mengatakan betapa sulitnya buat orang yang tidak tahu bahasa yang diterjemahkan maupun kata-kata yang sebab bahasa Mandarin itu tidak ada kesamaannya sama sekali dengan Sanskrit. Tata bahasanya lain, kosa katanya lain, cara nulisnya lain, lain. Makanya ini nanti, dan ditambah lagi orang waktu itu yang apa biku-biku dari Tiongkok belajarnya justru tidak di India tapi justru yang di atas-atas ini, Turkistan, apa Khotan dan di bagian mana-mana, dan mereka juga menggunakan bahasa yang agak lain. Jadi kalau kamu bisa bayangkan, kalau sekarang kita ini begitu malasnya menerjemahkan ajaran Buddha hanya dari bahasa Inggris yang bisa kita Google Translate, itu sebetulnya ini beliau itu mengingatkan tidak semudah itu kalau kamu ingin menerjemahkan, karena tujuannya supaya kamu ngerti. Jadi poin yang dikatakan di sini bahwa untuk bisa tahu bagaimana sulitnya menerjemahkan ini, maka beliau nanti akan membicarakan kira-kira seperti apa teks yang ada di sana. Tapi beliau terpaksa menggunakan kata scripture, Buddhist scriptures, meskipun pengertian kata scriptures ini tertulis. Tapi beliau, karena sebagai akademik, beliau sangat-sangat berhati-hati menggunakan kata lalu. Dan scriptures di sini adalah termasuk ajaran yang diteruskan secara orally tadi beliau. Ya.
So I want to begin by some observations about the sacred text, particularly in India, during the lifetime of the Buddha and practice. And then with a general picture of background, we'll be in a far better position to place the work of these pioneering Chinese translators
in place. Jadi di sini, sebentar. Jadi beliau mengatakan bahwa sebetulnya terjemahan itu, translating, itu juga dilakukan pada waktu Buddha masih hidup. Jadi saat itu pun sebetulnya ajaran beliau sudah ditranslate juga, gitu. Dan kemudian lalu Profesor Nathir mengatakan itu sebetulnya ada pakar-pakar utama dari penerjemah-penerjemah dari bahasa Mandarin ini yang penerjemah ke bahasa Mandarin ke Chinese. Saya enggak tahu ya waktu itu, do you know, bahasanya bahasa Mandarin sudah atau belum abad kedua gitu. She said Chinese, right? Chinese language. Tapi saya kok enggak yakin apa Han Dynasty, tentunya mungkin abad kedua. Tang jelas sudah Mandarin, you know. Tapi this early part, I just wonder kalau itu bahasanya, Chinese-nya itu bahasa apa? Saya, it's very interesting. Anyway.
It's also my hope that you know, I'll be focusing on Indian and Chinese, that these remarks may help also contextualize the distinctness of what took place in the country. I should point out at the beginning that on the handout which I already have, there's a correction basically within the text on the narrative, which says from Zanzara to Pali, I don't know how to get how one can get from the literature to college. It was supposed to be and I don't know how to get that. If you formed an idea of this talk from the program rather than the handout, change that word and it will be better. So the title is The Proto History of Buddhist Translation from Gandhari Anthropology to Hanuman. And if you're not a Gandhari Wolf, you're not familiar with that dynamic, I'm hoping to unpack that, as well as some really unpacking about the common side of things as well before we move on to China to describe the following. So one reason for focusing on the beginnings of Buddhist translation in China is that it's here, in the northern capital of the land, in the middle of the second century of the Common Era, that we see the first new examples of the translation of Buddhist scriptures into a non-Indian tongue.
So ini Profesor Napier mengatakan di Luoyang itu ibu kota China waktu itu di abad kedua, Luoyang, dikatakan untuk pertama kalinya Buddhist text diterjemahkan dari bahasa India ke bahasa yang lain. Sebab Pali itu masih bahasa India yang di India juga, tapi ini di abad kedua untuk pertama kalinya melompat bahasa. Jadi dari bahasa yang dari India diterjemahkan di abad kedua ke bahasa bahasa Mandarin. Okay.
But as soon as we raise the question of what translators were working from, we are immediately forced to deal with the fact that the translation of Buddhist scriptures did not actually begin in China. Instead, it had already begun several centuries earlier, in all probability during the lifetime of the Buddha himself.
Jadi dikatakan di sini bahwa yang jelas terjemahan ajaran Buddha ini tidak dimulai di Tiongkok, tapi dimulai beberapa abad sebelumnya, bahkan mungkin pada waktu Buddha masih hidup.
Itu semangat. This part of the story is rarely told, and much of it is only trying to clear some of the focus within a half century. So it's worth pausing to take a close look at what is known about the early history of Buddhist translation in India itself, before moving on to consider the very different case of China. To begin at the beginning, we'll have to ask some very basic questions. For example, what language does the Buddha speak?
Ya, tanya Buddha itu bicaranya pakai bahasa apa? Yang pertama ini.
Now, if you ask a pious Theravada Buddhist today, one of my neighbors in Poland, he'll be eager and quick to reply, he spoke Pali. And for them, the name Malayali, the language of the Mother area, where he was in the teaching, was in the sense of humor for Pali. In other words, they understand the humor to be the Pali.
Ini tadi jadi beliau mengatakan kalau kamu menanyakan kepada seorang biku Theravada, kebetulan tetangga dia juga biku Theravada waktu dia tidak, secara cepat biku itu akan mengatakan jelas Pali yang pertama. Lalu beliau mengatakan meskipun Buddha itu datangnya dari Magadha, yaitu di India di utara Sungai Ganges, dan mereka bahasa yang mereka gunakan adalah bahasa Magadhi, itu lalu juga dianggap bahwa Magadhi dan Pali ini sama. Jadi ini mulainya seperti ini sampai sekarang. Dia mengatakan itu tidak sesederhana itu.
To begin with what we do know, it's well established that the Buddha lived in the northeastern part of the Indian subcontinent, having been born in what today is the southern Nepal, and that he spent most of his teaching career in the region known as Magadha. So it does seem reasonable to suppose, especially as students, that most of his teachings were initially delivered in some form of what more technically is called old Magadhi, And it's referred to as old to distinguish it from our language, which is a much later language that was used for the transmission of scriptures belonging to the Jainism tradition.
Nah, ini cuma membedakan, karena kalau kamu lihat apa, kita lihat benua India begini, ini di North East namanya, timur laut India, karena itu beliau lahirnya di sekitar situ, dan negara waktu itu negara Maratha, makanya mungkin sangat-sangat mungkin bahwa bahasa yang digunakan adalah bahasa Maratha yang disebut Magadhi. Nah, lalu dikatakan itu mungkin digunakan Old Magadhi, karena kemudian bahasa Magadhi ini kemudian juga digunakan untuk menulis teks yang kemudian disebut New Magadhi oleh para Jain. Jadi ajaran-ajaran Jain kemudian berapa abad kemudian ditulis. Saat itu bisa kita bayangkan kan, tidak ada ajaran yang ditulis, semuanya oral. Jadi kemudian hanya Jain yang mengatakan menggunakan bahasa Magadhi. Okay.
But old Magadhi is hardly the only language spoken in India, or even more than India at the time. And few writers have really been able to communicate in more than one language, as Cameron has discussed in one of our references on the Magadhi.
Jadi tadi mengatakan juga bahwa yang jelas di India Utara waktu itu Magadhi bukan satu-satunya bahasa yang digunakan. Bahkan kemungkinan besar juga Buddha bisa berbicara menggunakan beberapa macam bahasa. Mungkin seperti dialek dikatakan. Bahkan kalau kita baca di sutra dikatakan Buddha bisa bicara bahasa apapun yang bahasamu, bahasa kita kan. Tapi ada kemungkinan besar Buddha juga menggunakan beberapa bahasa.
So there were also, in addition to this old language, there were many other languages that scholars refer to as Sanskrit, which is the first term on the Hindi alphabet.
Jadi dikatakan beberapa macam bahasa-bahasa itu pada umumnya disebut Prakrit, meskipun lain-lain. Prakrit di sini artinya dari Sanskrit di adjust menjadi beberapa bentuk Prakrit, disederhanakan, itu kata yang saya cari. Prakrit adalah Sanskrit yang disederhanakan, dan ini bentuknya bermacam-macam. Itu kan. Jadi di sini Prakrit ini khususnya digunakan untuk colloquial, jadi untuk apa, percakapan sehari-hari, dibanding dengan Sanskrit yang bahasa. Nah, kata apa bahasa-bahasa ini, dan untuk kalian yang menerjemahkan ini penting untuk diketahui, bahasa-bahasa ini disebut Middle Indic. Middle, karena di sana memang disebut Middle Indo-European. Seperti kalian tahu, Indo-European ini nanti jadi bahasa Inggris misalnya, jadi bahasa Jerman atau Prancis. Mulanya bahasa Inggris itu mulanya Sanskrit malah. Makanya masih banyak kata-kata menggunakan kata-kata Sanskrit dalam bahasa Inggris itu sendiri. Misalnya Vipassana, kalian tahu kan? Vi artinya itu memisah, to open. Kadang-kadang diartikan dua lalu. Makanya bahasa Inggris sekarang bicycle, dua cycle, you know, atau bipolar. Misalnya kata-kata ini apa urut-urutannya seperti itu. Ini beliau juga menerangkan.
I wanted to call your attention to the actual meaning of Prakrit and how it's related to Sanskrit. If you look at Manav, as you know, Prakrita is can be defined as natural or unrefined, or we might even say unvarnished. Prakriti, of course, is a very famous word in Indian philosophy. And the contrast.
Jadi kata prakrit sendiri itu dari kata dasar prakarti misalnya. Dibandingkan prakarti kalau dalam bahasa Hindu kan yang kasar, yang wadah, yang unrefined. Dibandingkan dengan mind, right? Pekerti ini prakrati, jadi prakrit itu sesuatu yang unrefined, yang coarse, yang natural, more natural. Di sini kata prakrit itu sendiri.
With Sanskrit, which is Sanskrita, which is surely a word that you all know, but in different contexts. In this context, we might say it means put together, in the sense of almost decorated, made beautiful.
Nah, kata Sanskrit artinya itu sesuatu yang dibuat, yang di apa, put together, yang di apa ya, yang dirangkai, yang tuan make it more beautiful, make it more good. Jadi Sanskrit itu yang lebih refined, yang put together. Prakrit itu yang lebih kasar, yang lebih natural.
Now it sounds from that pair of terms as though what we're talking about is Prakrit being made out of Sanskrit, and that did happen later in Indian Buddhist history. Early texts composed in Prakrit, the oral teachings were surely in Prakrit languages, local vernaculars. And then over the course of time, again, I'm sure this is familiar to most or all of you, Sanskrit became more and more the language of choice for the transmission of Buddhist texts. So by the time the Tibetans received this tradition, Sanskrit appeared to be the normal Buddhist language. But things were much more diverse in the early period.
Nah, ini poin ini penting sekali. Jadi permulaannya, ajaran-ajaran Buddha dimengerti dalam bahasa Prakrit ini. Bermacam-macam Prakrit. Mereka ngerti ya ini. Kemudian malah setelah beberapa tahun kemudian diterjemahkan ke Sanskrit. Jadi mulainya mulai dari Prakrit, kemudian diterjemahkan ke Sanskrit.
And let me just call your attention to how weird this situation is. The Prakrits are the daughter languages of Sanskrit. Prakrit is to Sanskrit as the Romance languages, for example, are to Latin. So Sanskrit is older as a language, but newer as a language of transmission of Buddhist texts.
Jadi dia boleh mengatakan, lucunya Prakrit ini boleh dikatakan anak-anak dari Sanskrit. Boleh dibayangkan, jadi misalnya seperti Roman language, yaitu apa, bahasa Prancis, bahasa Jerman, kemudian dibandingkan dengan Latin, mulanya dari Latin, jadi sebetulnya Sanskrit itu bahasa jauh lebih tua daripada Prakrit, tapi jauh lebih muda sebagai bahasa yang digunakan untuk menerjemahkan Buddha's teaching.
It's as if the early Christian teaching were in French, but this is obviously anachronistic, but as if they were in French and Italian and Spanish, and later were put into Latin.
Jadi dikatakan seperti French, Italian, atau Spanish, mulanya kemudian diterjemahkan ke bahasa Latin. Padahal Bartol kan dari bahasa Latin, terjemahkan. Jadi ini apa perbandingannya, Prakrit itu seperti apa Italian untuk French apa dan Spanish dibanding dengan Latin sama dengan Prakrit dibandingkan dengan Sanskrit. Jadi Sanskrit bahasa lebih tua, lebih menyeluruh, tapi jauh lebih muda sebagai bahasa yang nantinya digunakan dalam Buddhist text. Bahasa Sanskrit lebih tua. Oh, it's very logical. Karena bahasa semuanya yang Buddha waktu nerangkan dan diteruskannya ajaran-ajaran ini semua dalam bahasa Prakrit. Tapi lama-lama orang mulai menerjemahkannya itu ke bahasa Sanskrit karena Sanskrit lebih formal, lebih. Bisa kan? Misalnya begini, misalnya tulisan pakai bahasa Jawa, you know, Kakawengar Arjuna Wiwaha itu tulisannya bahasa Jawa nih. Tapi akhirnya nantinya diterjemahkan ke mungkin tapi bahasa Jawa lebih tua daripada bahasa Indonesia. Jadi ini agak enggak pas. Tapi artinya lama-lama menjadi lebih supaya lebih formal, lebih bisa dimengerti, itu lalu ditulis pakai bahasa bahasa Sanskrit. Ini sebetulnya kalau kamu kalian mau tahu ya, terjemahan pertama kali di dunia ini itu terjemahan dari Torah, ajaran-ajaran yang di Yahudi dari bahasa Greek, dari bahasa Hebrew diterjemahkan ke bahasa Greek di Alexandria zaman Alexander the Great. Mengapa? Karena dianggap semua buku yang berharga untuk dibaca itu semua harusnya tertulis dalam bahasa Greek. Jadi yang dulunya dari bahasa Hebrew diterjemahkan bahasa Greek. Tapi sebaliknya juga seketika itu juga, ini di abad kedua sebelum Masehi. Saya tadi lupa. Jadi misalnya kemudian di Rome saat itu juga ada diterjemahkan Iliad yang ditulis oleh Homer itu dulunya dalam bahasa Greek, kemudian diterjemahkan dalam bahasa Latin. Karena padahal semua orang pada waktu itu di kerajaan Romawi berbicara pakai bahasa Yunani, pakai bahasa Greek. Mengapa? Karena dianggap Latin ini adalah sumber semua classical books yang untuk ditulis. Clear on that one? Yeah.
So there's something interestingly backward about what happened language-wise in the history of Indian Buddhism. So what I'm going to be talking about at the beginning of this talk are these offspring languages of Sanskrit, different types of Prakrit that were spoken in different parts of India, especially northern India at this time.
Jadi ada satu bahasa di India Sanskrit, tapi di daerah-daerah mana berbicara semacam dialek kan, yang utama atau bukan dialek, tapi bahasa yang lain-lain tergantung dari daerahnya mana-mana. Yang dari selatan semua itu disebut Prakrit karena itu sesuatu yang more natural, yang tidak dihiasi, enggak terlalu dipolis.
So in this talk I'm going to be saying quite a bit about what I will call translation policy. What kinds of choices do we, and what kinds of choices did these ancestors of ours make in how to go about translating a Buddhist text? And I should mention, because this will come up later when we look at the broad cultural history of Buddhist translation, there's a prior question. Should we translate at all? Or should we all just learn Tibetan and recite and study the text in Tibetan? Or should we all just learn Pali and recite and study the text in Pali?
Beliau menanyakan gitu. Lalu apa benar ada gunanya toh menerjemahkan dari bahasa Tibet ke bahasa Inggris, bahasa Tali bahasa Inggris? Mengapa kok enggak kita tetap aja penggunaan bahasa Tibet atau bahasa bahasa Pali? It's a very interesting question.
Without saying in any particular culture that the translation of the canon is even going to be undertaken. So that is a prior decision. Do we translate? Or do we keep the sacred text in the original language? The second big decision, once you've taken the side of yes, let's translate, is of course how to do that, how to go about that. And that's really what I mean by translation policy, which I'll be talking about a lot today. So it's worth pausing at the beginning of this discussion to look at the translation policy that is attributed to the Buddha himself. In an account contained in the Vinaya, not only in Pali, but also in Vinayas belonging to a number of different ordination lineages, as I often translate this word, Nikaya, sometimes called schools, but groups that had their own Vinaya, groups that could ordain people as monastics.
Jadi ini beliau menyebutkan bahwa mengenai translation policy, policy ini apa? Kebijakan untuk menerjemah. ini seperti apa gitu. Lalu Profesor Nadia mengatakan mungkin kita perlu lihat sepertinya seperti apa sebetulnya kebijakan untuk menerjemah ini di zaman Buddha dulu.
So in the Pali language, the language that uses the Pali language comes to be known as Theravada in the modern world, but also in the Indian form into a number of other Nikaya.
Jadi lalu beliau ini mempelajari research di beliau ucapkan Vinaya, Vinaya, Vinaya. Tapi sebetulnya itu lebih benar Vinaya, how you pronounce it, bukan Vinaya tapi Vinaya. Ini apa? Di Vinaya waktu itu memang tertulis policy mengenai apa kebijakan menterjemahkan.
We find an account of what the Buddha had to say about it. And because it spread across these canons, Pache Gregory Chopin, of which this does indicate that it's old, Gregory sometimes argues that where canons agree, that means one borrows from another. There are such cases, but by and large, I think we're looking at a kind of stemma situation where there's a shared tradition that is passed on through these different Nikayas. And it's shared across a broad range of canons. That's probably what points to it. Again, this is an issue that if you'd like to talk more about that in the question period, I'd be very happy. So, in this story, we actually get a very clear-cut account of what the Buddha's own translation policy was said to be. In this phenomenon, so in this story, the Buddha is portrayed as opposing the formalized recitation of his teachings.
Jadi beliau mengatakan ternyata di Vinaya ditemukan bahwa Buddha itu malah mengatakan bahwa melarang ajaran-ajaran yang digunakan kecuali dalam bahasa yang bisa dipengerti, vernacular language, bahasa yang kamu gunakan locally, locally.
No formalized language, use the local speech.
Jadi tidak perlu di formalisasikan, diformalkan ajaran beliau, bahkan harus diajarkan dalam apa vernacular language. Vernacular ini seperti dialek atau apa, vernacular itu artinya yang kita gunakan locally.
According to this tale, there were two brothers who had been converted to Buddhism, and they were concerned, as good brothers might be, that monks, quote, of a variety of origins and family backgrounds, unquote, were corrupting the word of the Buddha by inciting his teachings each in their own way.
Ini diceritakan dalam Vinaya, diceritakan ada murid Buddha, dua murid Buddha yang dari kasta Brahmana agak khawatir karena kalau kalian bisa bayangkan kasta Brahmana menganggap kasta yang paling tinggi, paling ngerti mengenai ajaran-ajaran. Beliau khawatir kalau banyak pengikut Buddha itu latar belakangnya akan macam-macam. Jadi nanti kalau semua diperbolehkan ngomong seenaknya sendiri, apa melafalkan nadanya seenaknya sendiri, nanti bisa kacau balau anunya atau ajarannya. Ini.
Let us remedy the situation, the brothers suggested to Buddha, by putting the words of the Buddha into Chandas. Now, there was some talk yesterday about what you can't translate, what you maybe shouldn't translate. I've left this word chandas in italics in the written version, as you can guess, because the precise meaning of the word is on the topic of quite a bit of controversy. But we can say that in general terms, it is associated with the style of recitation used for Vedic texts.
Jadi lalu dua Brahmin ini mengatakan, apa tidak lebih baik kita formalisasikan memiliki canda tertentu. Canda dalam hal ini itu cara melafalkan dengan apa intonasi-intonasi jika kalian melafalkan Veda. Canda ini kemudian tadi yang saya ceritakan kan hampir sama bahasa Jawa kemudian jadi kanda, konto atau cerita apa cerita.
This is literature with which the brothers would have been most familiar. And let me just remind you that what's really remarkable about the Vedic text for scholars of languages, for Indologists especially, is that these were passed down orally for centuries, for millennia, in an ancient language that was no longer spoken, even by the Brahmanas. In other words, they were reciting classical texts when they were taught Vedic scriptures. And yet, that memorization tradition was such that every syllable could be preserved, which is why modern scholars can actually find out from these sources now, which are now written, what.
Jadi yang boleh katakan ini menarik. Ternyata Veda pada waktu Buddha hidup pun saat itu bahasa yang digunakan di Veda sudah tidak lagi digunakan. Tapi masih tetap dilafalkan persis silabel demi silabel, suku kata demi suku kata masih tetap dihafalkan dan dilafalkan sampai sekarang. Makanya beliau mengatakan para scholars sekarang pun mudah dengan mudah bisa trace Veda ini seperti apa karena nggak berubah sama sekali. Meskipun bahasanya waktu itu tidak dimengerti oleh dua Brahmin tadi yang dikatakan murid Buddha itu, beliau itu malah nggak ngerti artinya apa bahasanya. Cuma yang diperlukan dipenting, apa pentingnya bahasa.
But Vedic Sanskrit is like, we talk about the evolution of this language. So the brothers seem to have been arguing for doing something more elegant, more standardized, more familiar with the Buddhist teaching. So there wouldn't be, to paraphrase their apparent opinion, there wouldn't be all these riffraff of local accents, local dialects, messing up this important stuff. So, the Buddhist response to this, whatever the word, whatever exactly is the nuance of this word, chunda, and I'll send you to work by von Huber and Karen Allen, list of references if you want to know more about this. The Buddha's response to the brother's suggestion is not at all ambiguous. He forbids the recitation of his teachings in chanda, whether that means versified fancy text or whether it means actual Vedic language, whatever it is, he forbids that. But then he says, instructing his followers, teach the word of the Buddha, each in your own language.
Jadi ini menarik. Lalu dikatakan Buddha forbid. Forbid ini melarang. Ajaran beliau diformalisasi, dijadikan suatu paket di mana hanya mempunyai satu nada, digunakan dengan satu cara. Dia forbid, menggunakan kata melarang. Lalu dikatakan, lalu beliau mengatakan, Buddha mengatakan, mengharuskan ajaran beliau diajarkan hanya di bahasa yang bisa dimengerti oleh para lokal. Ini menarik sekali ini. Apa? Jadi unambiguous apa mengenai itu. Kata itu digunakan oleh Profesor Nadi, unambiguous, tanpa ragu-ragu, secara gamblang Buddha mengatakan itu, melarang diformalisasikan parita-parita seperti apa gitu. Itu bukan itu yang dipentingkan. Yang dipentingkan adalah dalam bahasa masing-masing.
So, as far back as we can go in the sources that are available to us, the translation policy attributed to the Buddha himself, you can't get much more authoritative than that, the translation policy was teach in whatever the local people will understand.
Jadi, polisi apa kebijakan penerjemahan waktu itu hanya ajarkanlah ajaran-ajaran beliau dalam bahasa yang bisa dimengerti oleh lokal. No questions.
To the vernacular, or to put in Indian terms, use the proper language.
Atau dalam bahasa India dikatakan gunakanlah prakrit, gitu. Nggak usah canda sih, pakai Veda segala, dengan segala macam intonasi dan.
Exactly what the Buddhists seem to have done in the early centuries. As I've already mentioned, there were many different prakrits being used in different parts of India. And this is not just something that we can imagine based on the trajectory from the Sanskrit text into modern spoken, supposedly sort of call them prakrits, but we don't, Hindi and Urdu and so forth. There are many work in progress in India, and we can actually obtain some concrete information about what they're like from the inscriptions of King Ashoka.
Jadi apa? Ini beliau menarik ciri. Ternyata Prakrit sekarang pun masih dibutuhkan, misalnya Hindi, Ugur, sampai itu sebenarnya Prakrit. Cuma sekarang tidak disebut Prakrit. Waktu itu lalu sebetulnya Buddha mengharuskan teruskanlah ajaranku dalam Prakrit. Artinya menurut lokal. Nanti supaya saya enggak mengganggu kalian mendengarkan ya, ini terusannya lalu ya. Ternyata dia, Profesor Nathir ini risetnya luar biasa. Kalau mau tahu urusan mengenai betul-betul meneruskan ajaran dalam bahasa-bahasa lokal, ini tidak bisa lebih jelas atau paling jelas bisa kita lihat dari peninggalan-peninggalan Raja Ashoka. Raja Ashoka ini seperti kita ketahui, beliau salah satu raja di India yang paling paling permulaan menaklukkan seluruh subkontinen India itu ditaklukkan. Jadi akhirnya Kalinga juga bisa ikut, jadi dinasti beliau itu sangat luas ke utara sampai ke selatan, bahkan sampai ke Myanmar, sampai ke mana itu menjadi tempat jajahan beliau, kerajaan beliau Ashoka, right? Nah, seperti kita ketahui juga, Ashoka ini membuat monumen-monumen di bagian-bagian di berbagai daerah ini. Nanti akan diterangkan oleh Profesor Nathir, ternyata yang ditulis di monumen-monumen Ashoka ini juga dalam Prakrit. Jadi kalau misalnya itu ditulis di Jawa Barat gitu ya, misalnya monumennya pakai bahasa Sunda ya. Kalau misalnya di Jawa Tengah pakai bahasa Jawa, yang di Bali pakai bahasa Bali. Jadi itu nanti tertulisnya pun menggunakan Prakrit. Untuk makanya ini personalnya membuktikan bahwa sebetulnya itu policy translation itu selalu menggunakan do not teach unless you use local language.
Who has messages to his subjects, PR pieces you could say, carved on stone and erected throughout his realm. And as you'll recall, Ashoka inherited a great empire already, the Mauryan Empire, but expanded it to include virtually the whole of the Indian subcontinent. The largest unified empire until the coming of the British in India. After the end of the Mauryan Empire, of course, things split up into smaller, still substantial, but smaller units. So Ashoka controlled a huge amount of territory. And his inscriptions have been found in a huge amount of that territory as well. Normally, when you talk about Ashoka, you dive right into the content and what a wonderful king he was and how he gave up violence and Buddhism. That's all immensely important and irrelevant to us here. What we want to know is what languages were those inscriptions in? And this is where scholars can use this material, because they are in a variety of Prakrit and even in some non-Indian languages. Ashoka's realm extended up into what today is Pakistan and even eastern Afghanistan. And in these regions, maybe some of you know this, but I still think this is amazing. There were inscriptions carved in Aramaic and Greek.
Jadi, Ashoka ternyata tidak hanya menggunakan Prakrit, tapi bahkan sampai ke utara, dekat di Pakistan dan di daerah situ, yang ditatah, yang diukir dalam monumen-monumen sekarang menggunakan bahasa, bukan bahasa India, menggunakan bahasa Aramaic dan Greek. Aramaic, as you know, the old language of the Bible. Jadi bahasa yang digunakan ini seperti bahasa yang digunakan oleh Jesus, is Aramaic, right? Itu bahasanya waktu itu. Dan Greek, karena itu nanti ada influensinya. Yang Greek jelas waktu itu Alexander the Great memang sampai di sini, dan yang Aramaic itu karena ada big dinasti dulu waktu itu yang juga menggunakan. Jadi kamu bayangkan ini, King Ashoka itu pengumumannya menggunakan bahasa daerah yang waktu itu dimengerti. Sampai
as well as in now that sounds really bizarre, especially the Aramaic part. This is the language Jesus spoke, it's a Semitic language from the Middle East. What's it doing in Ashoka's realm? Well, it seems very odd. Until we remember that Aramaic had been used as the language of civil administration by the ancient Persian Empire. That's why it's there. This is the remnant.
Jadi waktu itu Achaemenid, kalau kalian masih ingat, itu juga saat itu mulai jadi di paling atas Achaemenid itu paling apa dinasti paling gede waktu itu. Dan mereka tidak punya bahasa untuk bahasa tertulisnya, untuk administrasinya menggunakan Aramaik untuk jadi apa pengetahuan mengenai sejarah ini juga menarik juga.
Names of a Persian crisis.
Persian, oh ya, itu Achaemenid itu Persia, dari Persia yang sekarang Irak.
European using a completely unrelated language for their civil administration, their written communication. The use of Greek, of course, is part of the legacy of Alexander the Great in the description, dying about a century before the time of Spanish settlement. So those are bizarre and wonderful examples, the Aramaic and Greek, and they're given by language. And they can be compared to the progress to help translate one another. It's a very rich corpus of multilingual material. But for our purposes this morning, one of the most invaluable legacies of King Ashoka is that his inscriptions have allowed scholars to map out the variety of different progress spoken on the Indian subcontinent during his time. So,
jadi apa? Sekarang para scholars dengan mempelajari apa inscription Ashoka bisa tahu persis di daerah mana bahasanya apa, di bagian daerah mana di India bahasanya apa. Jadi, so they can study that. Nah, sebab ini.
It's possible to distinguish the linguistic and phonological features of Eastern versus Western progress in the middle of the 3rd century. So about, depending on whether you use the short chronology or the long chronology, a century or two after the time of the Buddha. So back to my Theravada times.
Ini sebelum kesini ya, jadi beliau mengatakan sekarang yang agak jelas bisa kelihatan pada dasarnya bisa dibedakan antara Prakrit bagian barat dan Prakrit bagian timur. Ini nanti ada hubungannya apa dengan Pali ini. Jadi bagian barat, barat di sini kamu lihat begini kan. Timur ini bagian Magadha segala macam. Yang barat yang nanti ke Afghanistan, Pakistan segala macam ini sih. Di Prakritnya lain bisa dibagi gitu. Sekarang ini beliau akan mulai membicarakan mengenai Theravada. Theravada di bagian mana nih?
Where does Pali fit into this picture?
Pali.
It certainly can be classified as one of the many Middle Indic languages. It belongs to that general territory, linguistically. And thus, in a certain sense, it's a prophet. But when we map Pali onto the picture, provided by the Ashokan inscriptions, we, illogical specialists, discover something very peculiar. For Pali does not fit the normal profile of an ordinary prophet. Instead, as the great Pali scholar Oscar Plummer has shown, it exhibits a mixture of Eastern and Western features, including some terminology that's thought to go back to old Magadhi itself, even older language. The majority of the characteristics of Pali, in fact, line up with what we know from the inscriptions would be Western progress, not Eastern. And this already would call into question whether it was anything close to the language the Buddha spoke, since the Buddha lived and taught in the Eastern.
Nah, ini penting, menarik. Jadi mereka map out tentang prakrit ini. Prakrit bagian timur dan prakrit bagian barat. Buddha datangnya dari sebagian timur, di Magadha. Saat itu juga ada yang namanya Old Magadhi, right, yang juga praktek di sini. Jadi sekarang bisa di map benar-benar oleh para scholars ini, Pali ini di mana pasnya. Tapi pada waktu di map out, mereka agak terperangah karena ternyata tidak fit kemanapun. Ternyata Prakrit ini bahasa campuran, sebagian dari timur, sebagian dari barat, cuma kebanyakan justru dari barat. Nah, meskipun ada Old Magadhi juga di sini, kalau jadi mereka map up mungkin bahasa kosakatanya, tata bahasanya, jadi berarti apa untuk yang Theravada klaim bahwa itu paling dekat dengan bahasa yang di apa gunakan oleh Buddha, ini justru perlawanan. Kalau memang betul itu Pali itu dekat dengan bahasa yang digunakan oleh Buddha, tentunya dari bagian timur, Magadha bagian timur. Tapi ternyata datanya yang paling banyak kesamaannya justru di bahasa apa Prakrit yang bagian barat.
But in the mix, it contains Eastern, some Eastern, and a majority of Western Prakritic features.
Jadi, some Eastern, hanya sedikit dari timur, kebanyakan dari Prakrit bagian barat.
Pali is, in other words, a hybrid language containing a peculiar mixture of dialectal forms.
Jadi berarti Prakrit itu hybrid. Apa? Pali itu hybrid language, bukan Prakrit yang digunakan di suatu daerah, tapi betul-betul hybrid.
Now I'm not going to go into all the ideological minutiae and cut to the chase, but to sum up the work of Fuminiura, this fact of the hybridity of Pali has some striking implications. As I said, it's clear that it was not the language the Buddha spoke.
Jadi jelas Pali jelas bukan bahasa yang digunakan oleh Buddha.
But not only did the Buddha not speak Pali, no one spoke Pali.
Jadi tidak hanya Buddha yang tidak berbicara dengan Pali, tapi tidak ada orang yang bicara pakai bahasa Pali seperti itu.
Pali is, as one of you recall, an artificial language.
Jadi Pali itu sebetulnya artificial language.
The reason I have trouble with lingua franca is usually that means something you can speak. Usually that it can be a marketplace language where people from different linguistic backgrounds can haggle over goods in some common tongue. And that's not what it's all about. There's a scriptural lingua franca. I don't think we really have a word for that. But used originally and only for religious texts. And I mean that broadly, not only for the canonical scriptures attributed to Buddha, but later for commentaries and for what we call church history, texts like the Dipavamsa in the 3rd-4th century.
Jadi Pali ini suatu bahasa yang di artificial, yang diciptakan, yang digunakan tidak untuk bahasa sehari-hari, tapi specifically untuk religious texts. Dan tidak cuma dalam canon, tidak cuma dalam Tripitaka, tapi juga komentari-komentari seperti Dipavamsa dan segala. Dan semuanya kejadiannya nanti beliau akan menunjukkan kejadiannya ada di Sri Lanka.
So Pali is already representing a bit of a divergence from the language policy we talked about at the beginning. It's no one's language, and ideally everyone's language, at least as a language for the study and recitation.
Jadi beliau malah nyelentik sedikit. Jadi sebetulnya Pali ini malah enggak nurut Buddha. Kalau Buddha dulunya mengajarkan bahwa bahasa harus menggunakan bahasa yang dimengerti oleh orang-orang yang dari darah itu, malah Pali itu enggak punya darah. Karena bahasa yang baru jadi dilihat, not only against the translation policy, tapi juga karena mereka ingin mikirnya ini di tadi Profesor Natil mengatakan it can be thought, bisa dibayangkan bahwa mungkin dibentuknya bahasa ini yang hanya untuk religious text, right? Pali Shastra, nanti Pali Shastra bahasa. Nah, ini hanya untuk apa, keagamaan. Jadi mungkin loh, mungkin orang yang bikin Pali itu berharap supaya nanti menjadi spiritual lingua franca of the language. Jadi bisa digunakan di mana-mana karena seperti Esperanto gitu. Seperti Esperantonya, artinya yang tidak mempunyai darah tapi mungkin bisa, malah bisa diterima di mana-mana gitu. Mungkin tujuannya seperti itu, cuma tentunya bukan, kejadiannya tidak seperti itu. Please.
So it might be a language of compromise.
Language of compromise.
Now, for our purposes, again, there's another rather surprising implication of this, maybe even shocking to some people, and that is that the text in Pali cannot in any sense be described as the original. When I say shocking to some people, I mean, again, a lot of my Theravada friends consider this the real Buddha-vachana. This is what he said, and it's in the language that he said it. That would be nice. We have no podcast from the Buddha.
Dikatakan jelas bukan yang diomongkan oleh Buddha, bukan original language.
In terms of a conference devoted to translation, what this means is the texts in Pali are not original teachings in anyone's dialect. They are translations, or at least transpositions into different wording using various proper elements. What term we should use for this is a little tricky, but I think as a default we could say they're translations. If you accept that word for translation from one very closely related dialect to another, the tasks are much easier, obviously, than if you're translating from an Indian language into Tibetan or Chinese. But it's a kind of translation in there. So, already in Pali, we see evidence of the change of religious texts from one, or probably many different languages being used for this, even in the region of northeastern India, into a fixed scriptural language. And here, again, I'd like to ask you as a handout, the word Pali is subject of a very old misunderstanding, not ours, we inherited it, the misunderstanding in medieval Asian tradition. The word doesn't appear in the Pali Tipitaka, Tripitaka. It's a commentary on it. It comes from a later layer of Buddhist literature. And when it does appear, it's the phrase that appears in is Pali Bhasa. Well, you know Bhasha, Subhashita, and so forth. Just the Pali language. So it looks like the name of a language, like the French language, or the Sanskrit language, or the Chinese language. But it's not. Pali, as I think some of you already know, doesn't mean a language name, it means text. Specifically, it means scriptural, religious text.
Jadi sebetulnya enggak ada sebutan kata Pali ini. Ternyata hanya ada di komentar-komentar yang terakhir, yang akhir-akhirnya baru keluar. Itu pun juga bukan mengenai seperti kalau kita ngomong bahasa Jepang, bahasa Prancis atau bahasa ini pakai kata bahasa. Pali enggak bisa disebut bahasa karena sebetulnya Pali itu artinya teks. Teks bahasanya syastra di belakangnya, jadi Pali syastra atau bahasa, bahasa yang berinjir di bahasa, jadi sebetulnya bahasa teks. Jadi sebetulnya ini misalnya ya, ada kata-kata tertentu yang digunakan di kedokteran gitu, kemudian kita nganggap bahwa bahasa itu disebut kedokteran. Nah, ini maksudnya Pali itu bukan nama bahasa sebetulnya, artinya teks. Ini kelihatannya akhirnya cekcok dengan tetangganya yang berapa. Pali bahasa.
This is a textual language created for a very specific purpose. So, at some point, Funny New Herbert traced this. I believe K.R. Norman has also talked about it. Asian Buddhists began to misunderstand this also as the name of the language. They forgot the Pali meant text and the particular kind of text, and they began to take it in parallel to other such expressions as the name of the language itself. If the language had had a name, it would probably have been Buddhist hybrid prophet or something like that.
Dia mengatakan seandainya bahasa itu mempunyai nama, mungkin kok disebut Buddhist hybrid Prakrit, bukan Pali. Gitu. Tapi memang bahasa itu tidak punya nama, gitu, sebenarnya bahasa yang digunakan untuk teks.
So, when these oral traditions were transposed or translated into Pali, this is hardly the kind of linguistic task or the dramatic change that we see in, for example, the translation of the Hebrew Bible into Greek, the Septuagint, or the transfer of the teachings of early Christians from Aramaic, again, into Koine Greek, spoken Greek, the New Testament. But where these are shifts from one language family to another, within India, what we're seeing is shifts among prophets, shifts from one Middle Indic language to another, as Buddhism extended into further regions. So, when did Pali become a church language? We don't know exactly. It's impossible to give this a specific date. But there's one very important benchmark in the history of the Pali tradition, and that is that the Pali scriptures were written down toward the end of the first century of the Common Era.
Jadi meskipun enggak tahu persis kapan dimulainya, tapi yang jelas dari benchmark ini Pali mulai ditulis, digunakan Pali teks mulai ditulis di akhir abad pertama Masehi. Dia katakan kurang lebih di tahun 20-an.
Traditional source. Why were they written down? This was done in Sri Lanka. The usual argument has been that there was a fear that as long as the tradition is oral, if the last monk who can recite the Gita Nikaya dies in a famine, you've lost it. If there's famine, if there's civil war, if there's an epidemic, and your tradition is dependent on the living memory of people reciting these texts, that's a good thing to want for part or all of the canon. So that's the normal reason given for this. Steve Collins more recently has argued that this was actually an intra-Nikaya feuding, and that those who wrote these Pali texts down were trying to get an upper hand in the battle. Well, they certainly did. The Pali tradition has grown larger than life in its impact in the contemporary world in the intervening centuries.
Jadi ini tadi ditanyakan, mengapa kok akhirnya ditulis, apa sebetulnya sebab ditulis? Beliau mengatakan traditionally biasanya alasannya karena kalau hanya tergantung dari secara lisan, nanti kalau orang yang hafal misalnya tiga nikaya yang terakhir meninggal, berarti ajarannya akan hilang. Biasanya itu yang dibuat alasan, dan itu juga diselilangkan. Nanti beliau akan juga mengatakan suatu tesis lagi pemikiran beliau yang luar biasa. Anyway, kita ikuti.
But be that as it may, what I want to call your attention to here is what a radical departure this is from earlier Buddhist practice. Not only Buddhist practice, but religious practice throughout India. Sacred texts are not written down. You're familiar with how the Vedic tradition was memorized and passed down the world. But it's not simply that they were good at this. It is, on the one hand, that if you pass it down orally, you can determine very specifically who gets access. And not everyone was eligible to get access to the Vedic text. So you can keep a kind of esoteric aspect to the transmission if you do this. You know, you don't lose the text and some unqualified person picks it up and reads it, finds it. But more than this, there's a fascinating passage in a Vedic text, a later Vedic text, the Aitareya Aranyaka, that actually describes a list of things that disqualify you for performing Vedic rituals. In other words, you have to go and purify yourself before you can then enter this sacred realm. And the list has a lot of stuff that we would expect, touching the corpse, coming into contact with blood, having sexual intercourse. But if you're taking an SAT exam, those things in this context can go together. But the next one is writing. And just to cover all the bases, or erasing writing. All of these were considered polluting activities from a Brahmanical Vedic perspective. And that's
jadi ini apa? Beliau ini menerangkan tradisi waktu itu di India dengan ditulisnya ajaran Buddha ini sesuatu yang luar biasa. Karena sebelumnya tidak hanya Buddhisme, tidak hanya Buddha Dharma, tapi seluruh agama di India bahkan tidak pernah ada yang ditulis. Lalu Profesor Nathia mengatakan dari segi Veda misalnya, karena memang hanya sebagian orang, yaitu para Brahmana, kasta Brahmana, yang diizinkan dan untuk membatasi untuk bisa membaca Veda, masuk akal kalau nggak ditulis. Kalau ditulis berarti semua orang bisa membacakan. Nah ini makanya kalau kamu mau membatasi sesuatu supaya tidak semua orang bisa akses ke situ, terusannya harus ada kualifikasi, kamu harus hafalkan dari jin para Brahmana. Jadi ini satu alasan yang jelas mengapa di India waktu itu tidak ditulis. Tapi lalu beliau mengatakan personalnya, tapi lebih-lebih dari itu juga ada aturan khusus di Aitareya, yaitu salah satu bagian dari Veda yang menerangkan bahwa hanya orang-orang yang tidak begini yang boleh melafalkan Veda, misalnya yang tidak menyentuh mayat, tidak menyentuh darah, yang habis berhubungan seks, dan juga tidak boleh yang menulis mengenai Veda ini, dianggap betul-betul tabu, betul-betul sesuatu. Jadi dilarang, malah teks itu memang waktu itu dilarang, cuma tujuannya mungkin seperti tadi dikatakan supaya tidak banyak semua orang ikut bisa akses dari itu, jadi tetap monopolinya monopoli para Brahmana untuk begitu.
How appalling it was then to write down the Vedas or the Upanishads or for anyone who is part of this world to think about taking a sacred text and putting it into writing. I'd love to know more about what's said about the impurity of writing in this period. I haven't been able to track down much information on that, but I haven't spent a lot of time trying to do it. The Aitareya Aranyaka is quite unambiguous about this being a polluting activity. So, I just want to underscore, before I go into the next project that I want to talk about, what an amazing deviation, as you will say, from Indian common practice this was to write down the sacred texts of the Vedas. Note where it took place. Did not take place in Malta. Did not take place in Mandya, the central area. It did not take place on the subcontinent. It took place in Sri Lanka, far from the Brahmanical heartland, out of the area where those constraints would have been fully in place. So I think that's interesting. And it becomes more interesting when we look at the other place that we know of Buddhist texts being written down. Amazingly, it's at about the same time, in the first century BCE, and at the complete opposite end of the Indian subcontinent, that is, in northern Pakistan and southern Afghanistan. And that language is the Gandhara language. This region was known as Gandhara You can find some wonderful things about that in A Good Introduction to the Word by Rich Solomon, who's really the father of Gandhari studies in the contemporary period, an immensely talented and wonderful scholar. His book is a nice introduction for non-specialists if you want to find out about these manuscripts. I'm sure you've all heard about them, but I want to say a couple of things about what's distinctive about this. For Pali, we have legend, tradition, history, maybe, the story of the writing down of the canon in the first century BC. The manuscripts that are available are well over 1,000 years later. There are two pages from the 8th to 9th century that were found in Nepal. Otherwise, it's most likely the 15th century onward. And Fungiver points out that the climate is packed. Things don't survive so well if they're not buried in the desert or somewhere at least a little colder and less humid. But for Pali, that's likely that that's when it happened. It seems a realistic tradition. For Gandhari, we have 1st century BCE manuscripts, carbon dated to that date. These are the oldest Indian manuscripts, not carbon from stone, the oldest Indian literary texts, we should say, could say, written on birch bark. That was the medium of choice in this area. And in the Gandharian language.
Jadi ini apa keterangannya sebetulnya menarik sekali. Pali waktu ditulis kan persisnya kapan mereka udah tahu kira-kira permulaan abad pertama Masehi. Lalu dikatakan ini betul-betul sesuatu yang luar biasa sekali karena menulis mengutip ajaran-ajaran tidak lagi diteruskan secara lisan tapi tertulis. Lalu proses akhirnya ini sangat menarik karena kejadiannya justru di Sri Lanka, di mana Sri Lanka itu malah tidak di Madhya Desa, tentunya tidak di tengah-tengah India apalagi di Mandara, tapi malah di luar India sebetulnya. Makanya ditulisnya malah di luar India, di mana pengaruh apa kebudayaan untuk meneruskan ajaran secara lisan ini mungkin tidak lagi dirasakan secara kuat di Sri Lanka. Tapi juga ternyata itu tidak sendiri Pali ini. Ternyata kurang lebih dengan bisa dikatakan kurang lebih di masa yang sama juga ditulis di Northern Pakistan, Pakistan Utara, di selatan Afghanistan, di daerah itu yang disebut Gandhara, juga ada tulisannya, sudah ada yang tertulis. Cuma yang menarik, yang di Bali, ini sekarang manuskrip yang ada sekarang, itu hanya yang pertama ada hanya tinggal dua lembar dari lontar, kurang lebih di tahun 1000-an berapa dikatakan. Tapi yang ada paling banyak yang lengkap itu yang paling tua adalah di tahun 1500. Jadi kurang lebih 500 tahunan yang lalu. Paling manuskrip yang ada. Tapi yang di Gandhara ternyata ada manuskrip yang jelas bisa di carbon dated 2nd century BC before common era. Jadi abad kedua sebelum Masehi ditemukan tertulis sudah. Jadi berarti di dua area di luar India ini, di Pakistan dan Afghanistan Utara, ajarannya memang ditulis. Tapi justru kalau hitung-hitungan mau tua-tuaan, ada kemungkinan besar yang ditemukan di Gandhara ini lebih tua daripada Pali. Karena Pali tidak bisa ditemukan. Anyway.
Beautiful evidence of Buddhist sacred texts being circulated in writing at the other end of the Indian cultural stream. So Gandhari is a Hindu prophet. It's from this area where Greek and Aramaic were being used. And interestingly enough, it's written in a script derived from Aramaic. It's written from right to left. But it's a Middle Indian language of the prophet. So it's a cousin of Pali. conflict, but very, very different, obviously, the northwestern side of conflict. And it, here, in the case of both Pauli and Gundari, we can see that the texts as we have them are translations. In Gundari, there are words that came over in forms that aren't allowable in Gundari. We can be very pointed at the same thing. So we can see some traces of what this might come from. So it's a remarkable picture. These are the only two prophets for which we have concrete evidence that they were written down in the Indian cultural sphere. And as we'll see, they both spread way outside the home church. So the Pali story is fairly straightforward. From Sri Lanka, it eventually gets exported to Southeast Asia and becomes the church language there. The Gundari story is becoming clearer in recent years with research by Solomon and his students and colleagues showing more and more evidence that the early textual tradition arriving in China may not have been by any means exclusively Gundari, but certainly there's a lot of evidence that some of the texts were in Gundari. Some of the others may have been oral. We know there's a mixture of oral and written material coming to China. So sometimes we can see in Chinese translations concrete evidence, like a transcription in a certain pronunciation of a term, that points to Gundari and doesn't line up with the other. So one of the minor growth industries in Buddhist studies is trying to figure out, in the case of particular texts, what this translates from. It's an enormously technical business, but it can be done. So there are some Buddhist translations that very specifically we can say, this shows evidence of having been done on the basis of Gundari over time. So we have Pali going out from Southeast Asia, from Sri Lanka to Southeast Asia, obviously by the sea route, basically, and then in the northwest, Gundari making its way along the Silk Road to China. And there have been texts, as I said, found in Pakistan and Afghanistan in recent years, but already almost a century ago, we had evidence of Gundari from eastern Central Asia, that is the Tarim Basin, the southern part of what's now Xinjiang in the People's Republic of China. One of those being Gundari Dharmapada, version of the Dharmapada. So it's clear that Buddhist texts were being exported through this region to China. So Pali and Gundari, that's what we know about of languages in which Buddhist literature was transmitted and written down. And there's probably a connection. The fact that it was written down has helped a lot to preserve these outside of India. And the fact that they were exported beyond their native region meant that other cultures kept them alive when Buddhism in some of these areas began to die out. So again, at the extreme of the Indic cultural sphere. What should be my target supplement time? Okay. Right. Thank you. I was kind of assuming that, I could have asked you before and forgot. So, thank you. Okay. So, coming into China.
Mungkin ini-gini, apa? Jadi, disimpulkan oleh Profesor Nadia, karena ditulisnya ajaran ini justru di luar India sebetulnya, di Sri Lanka yang kemudian menyebar ke Southeast Asia dan ke Thailand, ke all those apa yang sampai sekarang Theravada masih tetap ada, dan yang di utara itu nanti akhirnya diteruskan melalui ke Tiongkok, dan di sana akan ada bukti bahwa ditemukan dokumen apa manuskrip yang begitu tua, yaitu Dhammapada yang tertulis sebelum Masehi juga, dan ini manuskripnya ditemukan. Jadi kesimpulan yang Profesor Nadia terangkan, mungkin justru karena ditulisnya ini memungkinkan agama Buddha masih tetap disebarkan di dunia ini, di mana di India sendiri kemudian punah. Right? Jadi gini. It's 9 o'clock. Saya kira kalau diteruskan juga bisa. Cuma terusannya itu nanti narik ke sana. Tapi intinya di sini yang saya, mengapa saya usulkan kita melihat di sini. Ini loh, betapa sukarnya sebetulnya maintain this teaching. Dan meskipun baik dari Pali, kemudian yang tradisi-tradisi yang menurut Profesor Nathir dimulai dengan Gandhari ini, bahasa Gandhari kemudian jadi bahasa Sanskrit. Tapi ternyata acaranya ini masih tetap sama ya, dari yang nanti ini diteruskan ke Tiongkok. Acara-acaran ini dikumpulkan dalam bentuk yang disebut agama, yang dari bahasa Pali ini disebut Nikaya. Jadi di sini terus ada Majjhima Nikaya, yang dari Tiongkok disebut di sini Majjhima Nikaya, di sini Madhyama Agama. Ini ada kemudian misalnya Anguttara Nikaya, jadi di sana lalu juga ada apa Sutta Vertika Agama. Jadi dua tradisi yang kelihatannya lain ini ternyata semuanya sama. Saya kira nggak usah diteruskan apa tisma. Poin yang saya ingin berbagi ya malam ini, jadi kalian juga bisa istirahat karena besok kita mulai pagi. Kita jangan ikut terperangkap hanya karena kita belajar dari satu tradisi di sini berarti yang lain itu lain, atau hanya kita jangan juga terperangkap pemikiran bahwa untuk belajar tradisi misalnya lineage kita dari Tibet semuanya harus kita belajar dalam bahasa Tibet, apa harus semuanya dalam bahasa Tibet. Saya kira kita sekarang dapat jawaban jelas sekali dari polisi dari Buddha adalah yang penting harus dimengerti ajaran itu. Dan mengapa kok begitu, mudah-mudahan dalam beberapa hari ini akan menjadi lebih jelas bahwa dimanapun dalam bentuk apapun ajaran Buddha itu nanti akan isinya sama. Tapi kalian jelaskan ya sekarang, menurut saya waktu dengar ini luar biasa sekali, gamblang sekali apa pengertian mengenai Pali, Sanskrit. Jadi mulanya bukan Sanskrit, juga bukan Pali. Mulanya juga hanya Prakrit, kemudian yang malam, yang Pali itu enggak punya daerah. Kalau paling enggak yang dari Gandhara itu betul-betul diucapkan di sana. Ada yang mau ditanyakan? No? You're good? Okay, saya kira enggak usah diteruskan. Please have a good rest. Besok rencana saya begini, apa untuk beberapa hari ke depan. Mungkin kita mulai dengan apa? Melihat secara umum menggunakan teks-teks early Buddhism yang di early Buddhism sebelum berkembang menjadi macam-macam esestat. Tapi dari situ pun kita bisa lihat betapa apa ruang lingkup dari Buddha Dharma ini. Terus kemudian nanti kita unpack one by one aspect secara apa perkembangan yang tentunya boleh dikatakan history, tapi sebetulnya bukan karena sejarahnya, tapi semakin diketahuinya, semakin dimengertinya, kita menjadi semakin mengapresiasi relevansi dari ajaran ini ke kehidupan kita masing-masing. Oke? So menurut Yenjin tadi moving meditation-nya oke? Okay, besok we'll do it. So kita mulai jam 5. Mulai itu dulu aja kan. Yes. Ada yang mau ditanyakan? Nah, ini safe di sini berarti nggak ada teramatanya. Ini kelihatannya agak apa? Membuktikan kurang. Okay. Sit there. Kita mungkin just sebelum sebelum kita mungkin tidur dan beristirahat, just sit quietly, nicely. Kita coba rasakan bedanya aktivitas-aktivitas yang mempunyai motivasi yang lain-lain. Maksud saya misalnya beberapa jam terakhir ini atau hari ini kita gunakan untuk shopping gitu misalnya, atau jalan-jalan di resort atau di mana. Rasanya seperti apa? Atau kita bandingkan dengan apa yang kita kerjakan hari ini, kita pikirkan sendiri motivasinya sebetulnya apa. Tentunya bisa kita rasakan sebetulnya bahwa hanya ingin jadi orang yang lebih baik, ingin mempunyai kehidupan yang lebih berarti, itu membawa ketenangan di hati ini. Ternyata mempunyai motivasi untuk belajar mengenai cara-cara menjadi orang yang bisa lebih membawa manfaat baik untuk diri kita sendiri maupun buat orang lain, itu membawa suatu kenyamanan di dalam pikiran kita. Tapi yang perlu kita ingat, begitu banyak teman-teman, saudara-saudara kita mungkin yang tidak berkesempatan seperti ini. Mari kita pikirkan mereka dan kita bersama-sama membuat tekad kita, motivasi kita, bahwa waktu yang berharga yang kita buang di sini ini juga akan membawa manfaat buat mereka semua. Tidur malam ini pun dengan pemikiran bahwa kita butuh istirahat sehingga besok kita akan bisa bersama-sama lagi untuk belajar cara-cara membuat hidup ini lebih berkembang.